Let's think back to the campaign. August 2007. Barack Obama, candidate Barack Obama, was speaking on the campaign trail, and he outlined a policy and an insistence on the part of the U.S. government that sounded pretty plausible back in August of 2007.
There must be no safe havens for terrorists who threaten America. We cannot fail to act just because action is hard. As president, I would make hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. military aid to Pakistan conditional, and I would make our conditions clear. Pakistan must make substantial progress in closing down the training camps, evicting foreign fighters, and preventing the Taliban from using Pakistan as a staging area for attacks in Afghanistan.
Now, it is the case that the Taliban and terrorists are not necessarily the same groups, but the idea of safe havens for the Taliban in Pakistan is a fact as of today. This week, an agreement between Taliban militants and Pakistan's government takes effect, making Sharia law, or Islamic religious law, the law of the land in an area called the Swat Valley that we've spoken about a lot on this program before. Kristen L. Rouse, former Army Supply Sergeant in Afghanistan, joins us here in the studio. She has served along the Afghan border, not very far from the Swat Valley. She has some provocative ideas about what it means to have Sharia law be implemented in this area. Also joining us is Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Christine, thanks for joining us from Northern Virginia.
Thank you very much.
Kristen, outline the argument that you sent in a letter to the New York Times that actually became an op-ed piece, a very prominently displayed op-ed piece. You think this is an unworkable agreement that works against any goals that the U.S. and NATO have in Afghanistan.
That's true, and thank you for having me, John and Farai. My main intent with that op-ed is to voice my outrage and the outrage that many Afghanistan veterans feel about negotiations with or concessions to the Taliban. The story that I told in my op-ed was a story from that I experienced when I was based at Bagram, Afghanistan, the big airfield where there's also a large hospital. And also experienced on the ground by one of my fellow soldiers, Jeanette Martinez, who actually was on the ground when this incident happened. There was a school in Assadabad, which is in Kunar province. It's the capital of Kunar province, and it's approximately 70 miles as the crow flies west of the Swat Valley. And there were children in a schoolyard, and many schools are simply schoolyards because there's no buildings for schools. And girls and boys were attending a primary school together, and two rockets hit them. The Taliban fired a direct hit on the children in the schoolyard, and another rocket hit nearby.
The assumption being that the integration of boys and girls in school violated Sharia law.
That is correct. And seven children were killed, and 34 were wounded. And, I saw some of the children who came in for advanced treatment at Bagram, and my friend Jeanette saw those children on the ground as the incident unfolded.
Christine Fair, as a matter of moral outrage in the story described by Kristen here, and also as a kind of concession to political reality in the region of the Swat Valley in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, is there a way of keeping the Taliban out of either the Swat Valley or the area around Bagram that Kristen talked about here?
Well, I think the first thing is we have to be a little bit more nuanced as to the Taliban. There's actually not one Taliban. In fact, there are probably a dozen or so different kinds of actors, if not more, who are all calling themselves the Taliban. What I think is more disturbing than the deal in Swat, and let's talk very briefly about what, quote, Sharia, unquote, is being applied in Swat. The actual spontaneous courts that the Talib fighters had imposed have largely disappeared. And what they've put in place is a system called the Qazi courts. This is a traditional Islamist court that's been around in Pakistan for some time. I want to remind people that Pakistan is an Islamist country. It has a federal Sharia court, although it doesn't do that much these days. And what the Qazi courts are, they're basically staffed with Islamist scholars. In other words, folks who are on the government payroll who are actually quite educated in the various five strands of Islamic thought in Pakistan. And it has an appellate mechanism. Now, a couple of things are disturbing about this. One is that they extended this Qazi court system to areas well beyond those that were affected by the insurgency. It's like why they felt the need to negotiate a larger solution to those areas that were not affected by the militants is quite questionable. And I think that it actually is symptomatic, at least in SWAT, if not elsewhere, that the state simply has inadequate bureaucratic infrastructure to provide basic amenities to people, namely justice. And if you look at the way in which the Qazi court system has been laid out, what it really is appealing to a people's sense of due process and the failure to get justice in Pakistan's traditional legal system. Now, this is different from the numerous other deals, which are even more so egregious, that Pakistan has struck in Bajor and in North and South Waziristan, which those areas have a very direct set of implications for the Afghan Taliban, who are targeting our troops and those of NATO and our Afghan allies in Afghanistan.
Kristen, when you think about, you know, I've had the opportunity to speak to many people who have been on the side, you know, inside Afghanistan, not dealing with the Taliban in Pakistan. But there were concerns, at least initially by some citizens who were ruled by the Taliban, that they weren't able to envision anything but a lawless society without the Taliban. No matter how much they disliked the Taliban, at least there was a rule of law. Were you able to talk to anyone, even despite these bombings and what you saw with the children, who would argue, yeah, actually, you know, the Taliban does enforce some form of law?
Well, that was the appeal of the Taliban in the early 90s, when they first came on the scene following the Soviet pullout, is that they did bring a rule of law. But, we can say a form of rule of law. And, these are heavily armed people. But in the end, as I see it, these are people who also they exploit the dire poverty and the extreme the high illiteracy rate. There's been a drought that's been on in Afghanistan for some years. They're very prone to natural disasters. It's just these people exploit that weakness and desperation in Afghan society in order to impose their own social controls.
But does the U.S. have any options? I mean, some things are easier to negotiate from an outsider's perspective. Some things aren't. Could the U.S. have done anything differently? I mean, you make an argument in your piece that this is not right, in your opinion. But could the U.S. have, on a practical level, done anything but said yes?
There are voices and there are people in Afghanistan who do not side with the Taliban. As are
in the Swat Valley in Pakistan, though, do you think that the U.S. had a choice in terms of saying, okay, we'll go along with this?
What I think is significantly missing is the voice of outrage, a voice of condemnation of the way that the Taliban exploits this poverty and illiteracy rate to impose their rule. And, the fact that refugees are pouring out by the tens, even hundreds of thousands, I think shows the will of the people.
All right. Christine Fair, Kristen suggests here that any permission for the Taliban to be a part of the social structure is an invitation for violent militants to basically enforce brutal Sharia law in the ways that she's described in her piece. How practically can NATO and the U.S. separate the so-called responsible Taliban infrastructure from these other militants? Christine?
What I found so frustrating about the last exchange was there was this complete elision, this complete line drawn from Taliban and Afghanistan to the Taliban and SWAT, and it simply isn't the case. The people that are streaming out of SWAT are not only streaming out of SWAT because of the Taliban. Actually, the reason why they're streaming out of SWAT is because of the completely ineffective so-called counterinsurgency operations of the Pakistan Army, which have used fairly brutal air assets to decimate entire communities. So there's, in fact, 300,000 refugees, but they're not being driven out necessarily by the Taliban. The stream of refugees really came out because of the Pakistan Army's ineffective counterinsurgency operation.
Well, it's a balance here in policy between the moral outrage described by Christian Rouse and the complexity that you so articulately describe, Christine Fair. And I think the policy implications we're just going to have to see. But we'll leave the discussion there for this moment. Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Her op-ed is in the New York Times. Christian Rouse, former Army supply sergeant in Afghanistan. Thanks to you both.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.